Market Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Well, hello and welcome back to the Market Musings Podcast here from Stockbox, where today our guest Kieran Mulzaria, the CEO of Cadence Minerals, is joining us for the first time. Of course, Kieran, we have spoken a couple of times, me and you, on more general or news-based interviews on Stockbox there, as we're getting to know the Cadence story and how things are developing. But of course, on this podcast, we'll get to know you a bit more and what's driven you to where you are today and some of the experiences you've had in your career. So thank you very much for joining us. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. Working from home today, but just getting on with a mapper. That seems to be my predominant focus these days.
Indeed. Well, of course, that is the flagship project. I'm sure we'll be talking a little bit about a mapper at some point during the podcast. Kenny is joining us, and Kenny will be learning more about the company because, of course, it's the first time that Kenny is speaking to you as well. So welcome, Kenny. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, Mark. And great to have you on, Kieran. It seems like a few weeks since I've done one of these, Mark, so it's good to get back in the swing of things. And I'm keen to hear about your past, Kieran. And I know we spoke off here. And what really this podcast is about people make companies. That's what we believe anyway. You can have the best assets in the whole world or the best investments, but if you don't have the right people managing these assets or investments, then it'll never work. So what we like to do in this podcast, and really it's a bit like a potted history for yourself, is probably let you go back as far as you want. You can go back to your childhood, early education, first job, you know, whatever you want. You can go back and give us a flavour of your career and include all the bumps and all the highs and all the lows along the way, because, I mean, I've had plenty of bumps along the way, and I always believe you learn more for your bumps and your failures than you do your successes. So really, probably for the next 10, 15 minutes, hopefully we can hear a bit about your story and obviously lead us right up until the point where you joined Cadence and how that came about.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose where you start is where you, or for me, where it starts is where I sort of fell in love with geology. And it's an amazing subject, or the earth sciences, full stop. It's an amazing subject. And it covers, so when you're dealing with projects like a mapper, you're dealing with the deep time of the rocks. And for example, the mapper, the rocks in a mapper are actually from, I don't know if you saw, there was a great program on BBC called About the Earth, and it was one called Atmosphere. The deposit of iron ore deposits around the world is all to do with the great oxygenation event that occurred about 2 or 3 billion years ago. So the rocks that we're digging up, or will be digging up a mapper, are actually intrinsically linked to the creation of an oxygenated atmosphere, which has allowed life on Earth as we know it. And then so you get to deal with that stuff, and then you get to deal with the communities, how it will be impact. But what made me fall in geology was happenstance. Was I was sitting there stuck for a fourth A level, a third A level as it turns out to be, and I was lucky enough to go to school which had a geology course, and we used to live in Kenya, and we used to travel by train to and from the coast in Mombasa. And the train got stuck on a narrow gauge railway, and I had nothing else to do. And all the John Grisham books, or whatever the books I was reading at the time, had run out. So I was defaulted to this book on geology. And it was called The Earth. And I read that and I went, wow, this is quite amazing. So that started me on my career. I then decided at that point in time to do geology as a third A level and a GCSE at the same time. I was probably too young to understand the impacts of A levels, so I didn't do too well in my A levels and had to retake them. And then got accepted to university at the Camborne School of Mines. Again, yep. Maybe not realizing how good that school was, and how what such a great reputation it has around the world in terms of graduates of Camborne School of Mines. You see them anywhere around. I went there because of I like surfing, so, and Cornwall is very good for surfing, so I went down there for that. And really, you know, my time there was the formation of who I am today, and I started off as after that as a exploration geologist on the diamond mines in South Africa, and moved up to mine. I started off initially as a exploration geologist on precious metals in Central America. In those days, it was just after, you know, gold was at $250 an ounce or something to that there. And I had a choice of going down to hard rock underground engineering in terms of geotechnical engineering on some of the infrastructure that was being built in Hong Kong and doing hard rock geology or oil and gas. And I really liked hard rock geology. I liked the, as I said, the deep history, what rocks can tell us about the earth and how they can, you know, extract out resources, how they can impact lives and change the world and communities. So I went out to Honduras. I think I was being paid about $100 a week or something like that, because exploration wasn't a big thing then. And then I eventually went into exploration geology in South Africa and into mine production geology in South Africa. So that was optimizing mine plans, making sure you get out the most efficiently in the diamond sector. I then sort of realized that, and in fact, one of the mining engineers or the mine manager, after I started putting details about, you know, efficiencies and economics around stuff, he said, well, you're probably a bit more orientated around finance and economics. So I came back to the UK, did some engineering geology, did some recruitment, and that was mainly to save up money for my MBA. That allowed me to fund my MBA, did my MBA in finance at Cass Business School, and then sort of emerged into a relatively reasonable, coming up to a boom market in the sector in, I think it was around 2004, 2005, 2006 probably, and then worked for a diamond company, and eventually we bought a gold asset in Brazil, in Fiji, recommissioned that gold asset completely, and eventually sold it to a Chinese group, and that asset was a Chinese group in 2012, and that was an amazing experience. That was buying something out of receivership, dealing with a already established asset, which was still had stopped a bit of production, dealing with the complexities of how it impacts the community, the environment, dealing with government relationships, restructuring with creditors. So it was a real broad experience in that company, where I dealt with everything from the finance side through to the technical advisor to the board on the geology, which was a very complex epithermal gold deposit. And I think it's still operating. And so that's great. I mean, it'd been operating by the time I left, it'd been operating over 100 years. Impacted communities are about 2,000 to 3,000 employees, both direct and indirect, and made a substantial difference to the GDP of the country. So I like that. It was not a big asset. But it was a substantial and an impactful asset to the community that I was involved in. And that was a great thing. And in 2012, it was taken over by the Chinese. And I moved on. And frankly, I'd probably, you know, commuting to Fiji for one month or more. And we, with a growing family, decided that maybe being a bit more based in the UK would be better. And I got involved with Cadence Minerals, or as it was then, rare earth minerals. And it was really mostly just investments. So it was all about understanding exactly what you said at the beginning. When we look at assets, we try to find undervalued assets. So having a good geological understanding and technical understanding of the asset, is it in the right location? Has it got the correct geology? What are the indications surrounding it? What are the geophysical anomalies that you can identify from public available data? And looking at the management, are they sound? Are they exactly what you said? You've got to have good management. And we've done very well by investing in those those type of assets, mostly in the public sphere. But we decided as a board that actually getting our teeth into something and making a difference actually would hopefully provide much better value to our shareholders than just simply investing in public listed shares. And so that's what we've been doing with Amapa and getting back involved, not going quite full circle, but almost going back to my time in Fiji, again, restructuring all the creditors. This is a bit more earlier stage in the fact that we have to develop and raise finance to construct this asset. But nonetheless, the impact that it will be make and the fact that, you know, in one day you can be talking very deep technical detail about the mineralogy and emplacement of the iron ore, and then in the same day be talking to local communities, state governor, the regulator, creditors. It's such an amazing experience, and one that, you know, apart from the travel, I enjoy thoroughly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I like the fact that you say you got into geology because a train broke down and you ran out of books to read, and there was a book there that got you interested in it, and going to the Camborne School of Mines. I think a lot of people that we speak to on this podcast have been to the Camborne School of Mines. It's a shame, actually. I was told the other day that it's actually reducing some of its mining and geology courses there because there's lack of demand, which I think speaks for the sector. In general, it's just not that hot at the moment, but it'll probably go through a phase of them being under-skilled in certain people when the sector does kick. And you've experienced, you said, a bull market. Was it through 04, 06, you say? So you're actually involved in mining during a bull phase. I mean, you know, what was that like?
Yeah, I was involved during both, right? So when I graduated, you know, gold was at 250. No one was really interested in exploration and development. And then we had through 2006 all the way through 2012, you had that was, it was quite an amazing experience. There was lots of listings going on. And, you know, everything, all the tide raised all boats in that case, and some of them bad, some of them incredibly good, but a lot of projects got funded. And my involvement was really around the gold side. I was involved in some listings, you know, when we had that original, so between 2006 and 2010, I had the River Diamonds, was actually a Brazilian diamond deposit, which I deemed uneconomic. And we quickly sort of said, right, let's just shut that down and look for another chair to sit in, as it were, as my chairman at the time, Colin Orr Ewing, said, you know, it's a bit like musical chairs. You've got to find an asset to sit on. And that's why you're dead to have this Fiji asset. It was very interesting. I think I always focus on the geology and the assets and the people around them. So I didn't really get caught up so much with all that furore that was on the AIM market at the time, and really focused on developing the assets we had and developing the Fiji asset, which I think we acquired in 2009 and disposed of in 2012. Mm. But you talk about the whole lack of, you know, Camborne having problems with geology. It's just that these geoscience degrees are often viewed as dirty degrees, but ultimately there is a greying out of the workforce, including me, who's got grey hair in the last 5 or 6 years. But yes, it's getting an ageing workforce. And forget about skill shortages in the future. There are skill shortages right now. When you have to look at amount of mines that will have to open for, assuming, you know, electric vehicle penetrations go the way that and continue to go where they're going. I mean, in China, they're at 30% of new car sales. There's not enough lithium being mined or being developed at this point in time to support a penetration rate at that same level. So, and there are not enough geologists to discover it. There are not enough geoscientists to, across mining engineers, metallurgists, geotechnical engineers, you know, all of these, geoscience is such a broad subject. They're just, no one's doing it because of it's tarred as a dirty course. But in the absence of these people doing these courses, life, you know, going forward becomes hard because there is not enough people exploring, developing deposits that will mean that the third world starts to want to develop. We want electric vehicles. We want new technologies. And they're all in these new energy metals and things like rare earth metals and so on and so forth, we're involved in.
So do you feel that the reason is it's because the industry is basically tarnished with a negative thing, so that young people don't really want to say, oh, I'm going to do geology, because there's a stigma around it? I mean, it's a very interesting topic to discuss, because there are a lot of net zero people. There's the note, I forget what they're called, the oil guys who are disrupting traffic everywhere and say no to oil. So there's obviously a lot of anti, whatever you want to call it, exploitation of the earth. But ultimately, we need it, don't we, if we're going to go down the green shift? So there's kind of a thing where I think, you know, you've got to accept that to go down a green shift, we need it. But I guess at the moment, it's still, mining is perhaps still seen as dirty. And until, well, I don't know what the kicker is, to be honest. I don't know when the attitude will change on that.
Well, I think it's the responsibility of the people that are involved in the industry to communicate that in a way that people understand the importance. We have two choices. With climate change occurring, we have two choices. We either can say, well, actually, we're going to stop effectively no carbon emissions, completely reduce that to zero in some formal manner, and not let anyone in the world develop any further. And that's really unfair on countries that look at what first world countries have developed and what we have and say, sorry, mate, you can't develop. So you can either effectively reduce and go back to the Stone Age, don't consume. Or if you want a lifestyle, and if people want to emulate lifestyles that we have around the world, everything from cheap power, electricity, clean water, vehicles, transportation, then there is a way to do that. And that involves the transition to greener materials. And at the moment, there isn't those materials in circulation. They are in the ground. And it's our job as geologists in the geosciences, geologists, mining engineers, and metallurgists to process those in the most socially responsible, environmentally responsible way. And if at all possible, leave a sustainable overall project at the end. You can never have a really sustainable mining project, because mining projects have a depleted resource. So as long as you close that up, rehabilitate it. And these are really important parts of how you develop it. And for anyone to think that miners didn't think about this, when I was being educated, we were talking about closure plans. How do we close an asset? How do we ensure and return it to its state that it was beforehand? And for us, for example, at MAPA, that's, you know, when we did, obviously recently released our sort of licensing process, we start from the closure plan. That's where we start. We say, how much is it going to cost us to close this asset, rehabilitate it, and what is this asset going to look like when we leave? Mm. And that's absolutely important in how you develop an asset. Shareholders might just say, oh, how are you going to get to production? We think, obviously, that's important. How do we close this? Because if you don't do that, you're not going to get your licenses. You're not going to get your debt financing from International Finance Corporation. It has to hit to standards. And fundamentally, it's a moral responsibility for us as miners and, you know, as geoscientists to develop these things properly and ensure that the impact on the environment, not necessarily going to be positive, but is as neutral as possible, and the impact on the communities are positive.
Hmm.
So what is the kicker? I think the kicker is education, telling people that, because we're short of people. It's identified on the government put a strategic paper out basically saying that geosciences are critical in the education sector. And it's for people like me, people like other people like doing podcasts, to mm-hmm. people to be impassioned as I was about geology, as I am about geology and geosciences. And we're not just old blokes with rocks, as often, you know, there's this perception, there's an old bloke with rocks, you just go around, look at rocks. You dig stuff up and you pollute.
Mm, yeah.
Done properly, we have much less impact than the clothing industry has on the environment. And that's, you know,
really?
Yeah, it's clothing. Mm. There's no regulation. You know, our fast fashion, obsession with fast fashion, pollutes water so badly. When we deal with our water, we deal with it as much as we can recycle it, goes out through fill. We ensure proper mining done professionally has a minimal impact in the long term on the environment.
And do you get a sense at the moment of where the sector is or the industry is being typically cyclical, looking forward to the big push for net zero? Do you get a feel? I mean, I was talking to a geologist out in Africa, and I asked him the same question. I said, how do you know where we are in the cycle? And he basically said, I judge it on how busy I am. And, you know, I've gone through periods where I have no work and I need to do other stuff that's not geology. So I said, what are you feeling now? And he said, I am overrun with work. And I think we're in the start, maybe the second or third year of the next bull run. But do you get a sense? Do you use any indicators to get a sense of where we are and how it might go?
Everything from, well, not necessarily that I'm busy with work, but when you look to engage consultants, rates go up, not available. And we see that in Brazil sometimes, you know, when we're looking at environmental consultants, you know, you're having to squeeze them in, trying to get them in at the right time, and they're more expensive. So a lot of the skill sets there are in short demand. And if you look at, even if you look at consultancies in the UK, they're recruiting people. They need these people. So I think that's both a function of the lack of skills that are coming through. So there's a lack of people coming through, lots of people retiring. You know, when we were getting project directors involved with the mapper and project engineers who worked alongside me for the PFS, you know, we were bringing people out of retirement plus 65 to do that with appropriate experience. So it's both. I judge it from that. And also I then start, and there's leading indicators, because you know what happens is explorers start to look at new assets or look at new projects and start doing their PFSs, DFSs, exploration. Once they start to see the commodity price move, okay, or the product move, and in our case, let's look at the rare earth sector, or let's look at the lithium sector. Yes, the pricing has gone down, but it's still double of what most of what our investments are. So there is still an incentive to develop new lithium assets, particularly if it's out of the strategic control or geopolitical control of China. And in addition to that, rare earths are the same. Iron ore, well, ultimately, what are we looking at there? We're looking at where are the next big infrastructure projects going to occur? Is it China? It's not going to be 2008, 2012 sort of boom time where they're going to overdevelop their infrastructure. We see it in Central and East Asia. People who know much more about the commodity cycle than I do sort of forecast where that is going to be. So it ultimately, where the demand comes from, if there are not enough resources there, people redevelop assets, turn on assets, and then you'll get this, what happens, you'll get an overproduction of the asset and then a drop in the price and a drop in the cycle. And so it's driven by economic activity and we tend to sometimes overreact, and companies tend to overreact. And we saw that with the 2008, 2012, 13 iron ore boom, which then went down to, it was over $200 a ton for 62% material, and it went down to 54. I don't think we're going that way. There's enough iron ore out there, and it's a quite well-known and relatively stable, much more stable market now.
Okay. And would you get a sense at the moment then of perhaps where the sector is? Would you say we're in the start of a bull, not seeing it yet, halfway through it?
I think the iron ore is mature. And okay. It depends which commodity, right? So it's a mature, it's very mature. I don't think we're going to see a huge, unless it surprises me completely, I don't think we're going to see massive sort of consumption of iron ore that we saw by the Chinese debt infrastructure. You know, the building of houses, the building of railways, the building, that huge spend after the great global financial crisis, which they utilized to basically buoy their economy, was effectively infrastructure spending, which required steel, and iron ore, ultimately. So I see that more mature. I see a stable growth rate in China, and then more growth rate in places like India, possibly Africa. So it's not going to be as big. It's not going to be as state-sponsored. So it will be more gradual, and I think, and Europe is less of a growth factor. So I see it as a stable, mature market. And there's plenty of iron ore assets that are in production that can switch on and switch off now. So I don't see that there's a lack of supply. While in the lithium sector and the rare earth sector and copper, nickel, so anything to do with electrification of vehicles and batteries and wind power, wind turbines, you know, that whole system of creating energy without the burning of hydrocarbons and storing it and utilizing it to transport ourselves, power our houses, that requires a shift in infrastructure. And so all the metals associated with that, there will be some iron, but a lot of it, where I can see the gap is, and always have seen it since 2016-17, when there was a mini boom in lithium, it is lithium, and lithium plus others. But lithium we invested in because it's not a commodity, and there was a substantial shortfall. There's a structural deficit. And our adoption of electric vehicles is not determined about how many we want. It's actually determined about how much lithium we can produce at the moment. So I see that at the beginning of the cycle, frankly. I see that we should, over the next 10 to 15 years, EV penetration will go from, let's say, somewhere like, let's, I don't know what it is at the moment, 10, 15% around the world, but in first world countries, whether and China and Europe, we will be in 60, 70% penetration rates of EV vehicles overall. That's my view, and that is multitudes. You're talking, I think, Benchmark Minerals put 50, 60 mines, lithium mines need to be constructed, and we're not anywhere near that at the moment. So I see that as the beginning of the cycle.
Yep. Kieran, can I just take you back to your sort of career? And obviously, there's been a clear sort of transition from your passion, which was exploration and geology, and you kind of moved into management, you know, just slowly over time. Was that a career choice? Did it just happen by accident? You know, right place, wrong time, or wrong place, right time, whatever you want to call it. How did that come about? And obviously, so, being a geologist.
So when I was in South Africa, I was sort of being a mining geologist, so effectively planning that help the miners plan the most effective and most cost-efficient and way to mine these alluvial diamonds. And alluvial diamonds are very nuggety. You have to take big samples to determine the grade. And so it's very geological led. It's not like iron ore, which is a mass mining and pretty uniform in grade. That I started sort of, I'm trying to really push the economics and the finance and the impact. And I also realized that I really liked the finance side of it as well. So then the mine manager actually got upset with me because I started doing his job and putting in some sort of predictive, using Excel and macros, sort of predictive points about future cash flow from each of the pits and, you know, using some Monte Carlo simulations to understand the probability of getting those and where our risk would be. And so, and then I realized that I quite liked that side as well, the data driven side, which in geology, you do a lot of data when you're dealing with resource modeling. And then I'll do an MBA in finance. And also I went, I don't want to be realized sitting in the field. I don't want to spend the rest of my life in the field. There must be a role that I could do that could have a happy marriage of the two. And that's working within small companies. If I'd gone into Anglo or a Rio Tinto at the time after my MBA, which was possible, I would have been very much pigeonholed and not had the contact. And being with small companies and small or medium-sized companies, you get to do everything and get to be involved in a lot of things. And I love that. I don't necessarily want to be sitting there core logging for 8 hours a day. I'd rather dive in there, talk to the geologist. What's the core logging? How's that going? Have you done this? Have you done your geotechnical side? Where, you know, looking at PFSs, have you covered all the bits and pieces? And also then dealing with, as I mentioned before, communities, people, government and creditors in this case. So I like it all. So it was a transition that was pointed out to me, and I realized, oh, what's the next step? And then talk to my parents, and they suggested doing an MBA, and that's what I did. And that then brought me into management.
Yeah, so you've seen sort of both sides of the spectrum. You know, you've been at the coal face. You know, you've been down there with the rock chip samples, you know, soil samples, surveys, you know, mine development, etc., all the way up the corporate ladder, you know, to finance and stuff like that. Obviously, you've got to deal with people all the way up. I mean, how important? I mean, we talked about it earlier on, but I mean, having the right people is critical. So, how did you manage people on this journey on the way up? Because people are difficult to manage. So that, I mean, I've worked in a wide variety of industries, and you meet all sorts, and there's different management skills. You know, some people have just got a JFD attitude, just get on with it. You know, other people you've got to kind of coach into it, or give them a good or a bad option. It's sometimes a difficult path, so it is to tread.
I think it's more of, I've tried to think about how that is. You know, earlier on my career, it was dealing with much more junior people in terms of drillers and field assistants, and that's relatively easy. I mean, apart from some sort of in South Africa, there was still some racial tensions. You know, when I arrived, this was post apartheid. I can remember going up to the bar, and there still was an entrance for white people, or wits, and an entrance for coloureds or blacks, which was just mind-blowing for me, coming, you know, I'm half Indian and half Brazilian. So I had to, apart from dealing with those, that was the most difficult thing. Otherwise, it was treating people with a level of respect, you know, making sure that if they're doing their job properly and delivering on time, I let them get on with it, because I respect that a driller knows far better than I could ever drill, you know, an air core rig and they're hard men, and mostly men, and that they are men they were men in that case. And that was much easier to deal with. But I suppose I took that attitude all the way through, is, you know, my style of management is collaborative. And getting people to come up and come to me with a delivery. But I do sometimes, probably one of my biggest failings is I sometimes micromanage. If I feel that someone's not doing it properly, I will then take it off it and do that myself, which I recognize as one of my issues is micromanagement of certain aspects of projects. So, and that then can upset people. So I that's one thing I tend to try and work on, is coach people to do it the way that I would like it done, and also listen to why maybe I'm wrong in my approach. So, and being personable, being open to their conversations, talking to them, and really understanding where they're coming from. There's certain things that are very task orientated, and certain things that are not task orientated and creative. So, different styles of management, and how I balance my get it done by this date, and where are you finding the issues? Don't tell me at the last date that you're not there on time. Give me every week an understanding of where you are, where your problems are, how we can fix them for you to achieve these goals. And in Brazil, that's how we did the PFS, and we'd hoped to have got it released a bit earlier, actually, when we would hope to get it released in October, but it lagged. And that was a problem with some regulation changes and having to redesign those things you can't change. I'm not going to shout at anyone because of that. But it's a collaborative approach, understanding where people are from, helping them achieve their goals, and giving them due credit, you know, when they achieve things, because ultimately I rely on the performance of these people to achieve things like a mapper, the PFS. I was involved with it. I was a project manager in it, but there were countless other people that needed to execute it. And if they didn't, we wouldn't have been able to achieve it. And they needed the right incentive, the right guidance. And some people hadn't done PFSs before, so helping them along the way. So it's a collaborative approach, as my management style is probably the best way to describe it.
Yep. Excellent. Excellent. And just staying on your career before we sort of go on to Cadence and how that came about, although you touched on it earlier. I mean, successes and failures, you know, it sounds like you've had a pretty successful career, but I'm sure there's probably something in there that's happened that, you know, whether it was market conditions or, you know, the truth machine didn't give you the results you wanted. I mean, there must be a failure in there that you've learned so much from.
So look, when you're involved in geology, and you're not maybe involved in, so early on, I'm not involved in the decision of the area that's going to be explored. I'm given an area to explore, and the drill exploration is a highly risky business. And so on average in the market, there are more failures than successes. I was getting and I often quote it, and I was actually doing it in a presentation in a couple of days' time. You know, if you look at, let's say, 1,000 exploration deposits or exploration prospects, so really early stage, maybe only of that 500 to 1,000, one will get to become a mine. So, of course, I've been involved with projects that haven't been successful. And that actually drives some of the reasoning behind Cadence and what we do there. So my first exploration asset, well, the two exploration assets in South Africa, weren't successful. Disappointing, but I'd write that the key there is to cut it short as quick as possible and not waste any money on it. The mine was successful, but that was already in operating. The early exploration in Central America, it looked interesting, but, you know, hindsight, it wasn't big enough. It was a small gold deposit that was never really going to get developed. But I was young and happy to be in the tropical islands. Well, happy to be in Honduras and then the tropical islands going diving after that. My concern necessarily wasn't in the finance. And then, you know, so exploration always has, more often than not, is disappointing. So you have to have a positive attitude and go, right, well, let's learn from those mistakes. Let's try and improve those odds as we go along. And that's what we do with Get Cadence. And then I suppose I was younger. I was, as I said, I, you know, didn't get good enough grades in my A-levels the first time. I was just having too much fun. So, you know, learning that those failures you just have to go back and work harder, and certainly with A-levels, work harder and understand the time commitment required to achieve results is probably the amount of time that is required to achieve good results, especially in those sort of things.
I think it was one of the Hemlo gold deposits. It was something like the 64th drill hole or something before they actually finally hit the mother load. You know, it was almost like a pin in a haystack, but once they actually, you know, used the initial holes to narrow it down, then they got it. So
it's not giving up too early, but I, you know, often, you know, with something like that, they would have had a lot of geophysical evidence, and the conclusion was it has to be in these areas, it has to be at this depth. But geology is funny. It could have also been, it could have not been there, right? Geology sometimes chucks up stuff. I remember looking at Brazilian kimberlites, after I shut down that diamond mine in Brazil, or diamond prospect, I would never call it a mine. There are kimberlites in Brazil. So kimberlites are the source rocks for diamonds. So why are they not diamonds? There's a long geological reason why, but there isn't. But we were seeing if the people had got those theories wrong or those hypotheses wrong. But, you know, you can have sometimes the best indicators in the world, but still not a deposit. And there are stories of people not recognizing some of the largest kimberlites in the world were just where people were looking for different deposits and had set up their camp on a very large kimberlite in Namibia, and then the geologist from the next camp identified it, and once that license was given up, staked one of the largest kimberlites in Namibia. So it's a bit of luck, but
oh yeah, you always need luck. So you everything you do in life sometimes. Definitely. All right, so we've covered your career, you know, the highs and lows, successes, the journey, the transition from exploration to management. Can I touch on how Cadence came about? Give us a sort of high level overview of Cadence. Obviously, it's an investment vehicle, and maybe give us a sort of strategy, you know, how you're different from other investment vehicles on the market at the moment.
Yes, thanks, Kenny. So Cadence Minerals is what I would call a responsible resource investment company. We came out of the fact that we were a rare earth, we were originally called Rare Earth Minerals, which was an investment company focusing solely on rare earths. And we then focused our investments on what we believe are metals and materials and commodities that are required for the change to an electrified and particularly working towards a carbon neutral environment. So that not only means that we are looking for assets that help us achieve that, and iron is one of those as well. And we're also looking for assets in particularly the companies that have an attitude of how they're going to mine, and they mine in a responsible manner. So, for example, we have an investment in European Metals Holdings. It's a very large lithium deposit in the Czech Republic, and it is going to be very strategic because it will produce a final lithium product rather than a pegmatite concentrate that needs to get shipped to China. So its distance to, it has to travel to produce a lithium hydroxide or lithium carbonate is very short, and also geopolitically you are producing your final product locally. In addition to those factors, it also has its advantage. It also has already completed its carbon footprint assessment and looking on how to improve that further. So it's about investing in companies that both, yes, deliver excellent returns to our shareholders and onto our investments, but also they do it in a response. They invest in the projects that they develop are responsible projects or responsible mining projects. And if at all, if they can build that into a ecosystem that is sustainable, that's really important as well. So it's investing as a strategy, is investing in some key elements and key compounds that will provide our journey toward net neutral, and that the companies themselves are responsible both socially and environmentally. And lo and behold, you know, especially in both of those, they actually end up in the long term delivering excellent returns. So that then achieves our vision, you know, our strategy of getting excellent returns from these assets, and also that then allows us to grow capitally. So, you know, that's how I would differentiate us slightly from the other groups. Of course, all investment companies should be doing the right thing in terms of, you know, looking, as you guys mentioned earlier on, how competent the management, are they the right management to execute a project? Is it in the right locality in terms of a stable jurisdiction? Are the commodities or investment, you know, got a long-term demand that you can see continuing through the project lifetime, through its development and project lifetime? And is the geology good? So, you know, those are a given, those four items, but the rest of it I see is our differentiation.
And is it fair to say, Kieran, that AMAPA is your flagship project, the one where your focus is going to be mostly?
Yes. So I spent, AMAPA came out of a decision in 2018, in that we wanted to be managers or part managers of our own project because we've, in a sort of private equity manner, mm-hmm. Because we felt we could add a lot of value. And And, you know, I spent the majority of my time on it. So last year, particularly as we were doing the PFS or the pre-feasibility study, and we got our ownership in 22, I suppose 75% of my time was involved in there. And this year, as some of that technical stuff is not as intense, it will be again when we get to definitive feasibility study, but at this moment in time, I'm probably spending about 65% of my time on it.
Okay. And you say you got you announced the joint venture in 2019, but you didn't actually acquire the project until 2022. So that took a little while, didn't it?
Yes, it did, and certainly not a timeline I was ever expecting or our joint venture partners were ever expecting. Ultimately, the price, we took this project out of let's call it a Chapter 11 or a judicial recovery, which requires all the creditors to agree to your plan of rehabilitation. How are they going to get their money back effectively? So we got that done with all the unsecured creditees in August 2019. That was approved by 90% in value of all of the creditors who approved our plan. So that was a good stamp of approval. But we also needed to get secured creditors for various legal reasons. They fall outside of the JRP. And they indicated to us at the time that they were agreeable to our plan and how they would get paid. Payback. However, sometimes that didn't turn out to be the case, and they took a very long time. COVID probably had something to do with it as well, to agree to a payment or a settlement agreement with them. And it was only until we had that settlement agreement, which was at the tail end of 21, that we could get our ownership in early 22. So it wasn't for a lack of understanding or a lack of trying to get this deal done quicker. We wish we could have, because we would be very much up there. I think we'd probably be completed construction, started operations by now, if all had gone well. So it's unfortunate, but sometimes, you know, the negotiating party is not necessarily driven by commercial reasons, maybe driven by other reasons as well to reach a settlement. Mm. So that's why it took long, certainly not expected by any of the parties, including the court in Brazil and all of the JV parties involved in the investment in the MAPA.
I mean, what would be the intention, several years down the line for a disposal? Would it be sort of dividend return to shareholders? Is it reinvest and go again and look for shareholder value that way? I suppose every project's different, you know, how the disposal occurs, but do you have a certain model you would like to try and follow?
Yes, as you said, every investment is different. And as you can see from our investments, we have both public equity, and we have private investments, particularly when we talk about the Sonora Lithium project and our MAPA iron ore project. Ultimately, we are looking initially at capital growth because we want to see these assets so that we have our book value so that we can continue to increase it. We've talked previously about getting a 200-300% return or better. And, you know, once we achieve that, we can then utilize an exit, whether it's a public market exit or a trade sale exit or something to that effect, to then reinvest and grow the company. And there will be a point when we don't see investments or value in the market, that you could return capital to shareholders. That would initially, just because of how it works legally, probably a share buyback. And then eventually, if we continue to be successful and grow quite considerably, it would be a dividend. But really right now, our focus is to be capitally grow the projects and utilize the capital gains from that to fund new investments into projects that have larger investments that have similar returns, and also therefore also funding the overall overheads, the due diligence, all the work that we go into and management of these companies, funding that. So our first objective is capital growth to fund new investments, larger investments, same sort of returns, and which will also allow us to fund ourselves as an entity, therefore mitigating, if at all possible,
going to the market for capital. So it's not a specific method of returning shareholders, but I think let's be clear, it's about capital growth, and capital growth will return value to shareholders because they can vend their shares and make those gains as well.
Okay. And I mean, if you were to, I know we've spoken about this before on the first interview that we did, but the sort of book value that you're attributing all the projects to be to Cadence, of course, the market cap at the moment is, well, under 15 million, which is, you know, that's pretty low for a company that has, you know, a number of projects on the AIM market. But it's also reflective, I think, of that the market in general, really. You see lots of companies having the valuation is often around this level. I think it's used to, only a year or two ago it might have been standard around 20-25 million, but now it's sort of standard around 15, a company that has projects anyway. Do you have a book value, like, I mean, to date?
If we, as you pointed out, you know, our market capitalization is just under 15 million quid. In our view, that's substantially below, and analyst views, that's substantially below a lot of people's estimates of the eventual value. But let's look at the book value as a lower case. So in our public equity that we have, so these are the listed assets that we have, which primarily include European Metals Holdings, Hastings Technology Minerals, and those are the two largest holdings, and we have some smaller other ones as well. Evergreen Lithium. Between those three, plus some other smaller ones, we're sitting around the £8 million mark. So we have £8 million there. And then when we look at a mapper based on the last price we paid is around the $30 million mark. So let's call that a total valuation of somewhere in the region of 36 million pounds worth in terms of book value. Other analysts have put that valuation higher. Edison gave us a share price of somewhere in the region of, I think, 30 pence all the way to, on the higher end, Kemeny Capital on the upside, closer to 70p. So there are three analyst notes there, which will also provide some understanding of how they value it. The majority of that value comes from a mapper and its fruition, clearly, with the other assets, like the private assets, the publicly listed assets valued at the market. So yeah, I hope that answers the question.
Well, yeah, indeed. So approximately 36 million, that's very much above, more than double above where you are at the moment. But of course, it doesn't include the upside there to, well, the other investments, but also, of course, the Imapa, which, as you said, is potentially very, very significant. So yeah, you can clearly see a bit of a difference there in valuation compared to perhaps what it should be. But that's the way of the market, isn't it? So not much we can do about that at the moment.
Yeah, indeed, it's been it's difficult in the markets, specifically when you have such a, and the name's had a pretty torrid year so far. But hopefully, I think we can see some green shoots coming out, you know, with economies returning and specifically some of the stimuluses in China working. Certainly, we've seen some really improvements in iron ore, which is positive for our asset in Imapa.
Of course, or hopefully the market recognises at some point, perhaps as you start to, as you spoke about with Kenny, they're liquidating or getting an exit on some of the other projects that you have a stake involved in. But of course, Imapa getting that advance and significant news, we only discussed this yesterday. Of course, you're able to accelerate that installation license, the actual permission to build, the planning permission, if you like, to build, you want to be able to be in a position to have that permission within sort of 12 to 16 months. And you're going to actually formally apply for it early next year. Well, Q2 next year, weren't you?
Yeah, so we were going to do all the background study. So what we've done is we've talked to the state and saying, what do you need for us to get the installation license? They said, well, we need you to complete these various things. And these are all the environmental, community, engagements, background studies. So we do those, prepare the report, and that report gets submitted to Q2 next year, and then the
state then reviews that and approves that. And so that's why I say that, you know, we would, you know, 12 to 16 months as a timeline, we would hope to get those licenses. And they will may occur in varying forms, because some of those licenses don't require as much work, the mine and the railway, while the port requires a fuller environmental impact assessment.
Mm. And you have all the, you are funded to go through this process. Of course, when it gets to construction, you're going to have to look at, well, yeah, some, you said a joint venture, didn't you, potentially?
For DFS, I think we've been clear about that. So we are funded. We did raise capital through a loan earlier in the year, which we intend to pay back with cash. And we can use that from our equity stakes across the board. So we can pay back our loan by the sale of EMH, or, which is in escrow. And we can also utilize the other assets that we have liquid as to fund a mapper.
Okay, well, that's good. So you can, yeah, you can liquidate some of those assets to indeed pay. Would that be the plan almost then, to actually then just scale out and focus purely on a mapper? I mean, it's big enough on its own, isn't it, to be a project for a company such as yourself?
I think the majority of my time and effort is going to be on a mapper, yes. Okay. And we will continue to be, and we'll be passive. I still think we'll have investments in EMH and some other small stakes that we have. And Hastings into next year, and we'll also have our stake, because I think we'll be able to fund that with not the wholesale but a part sale of these assets, which have already generated good returns.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Kieran. Do you have any final thoughts, Kenny?
No, I'm all good. All good. I think that's almost an hour. I mean, like I say, these things are not structured. We just go on the podcast and we talk away, and before you know it, an hour's gone. So, no, appreciate your time today, Kieran.
I can rub it on when I get talking about geology. I could have spoken another half an hour on the origins of the great oxygenation event of over 2 billion years
ago. I was going
to
ask you about that. I wrote that down as a point, but I thought, do you know what? We've spoken quite a long time, and I thought, if I'm listening to this podcast, I'll be Googling that myself and reading about it. But I was going to ask you, but maybe we save that.
There's a great series. It's called Earth, and there's four programs on Earth, and it's all about the geological history of Earth. It's got Chris Packham presenting on it. Obviously, it talks about the impact of the environment and so on and so forth. But there's one called Atmosphere, and that is about the great oxygenation event and how iron ores, basically the large majority of iron ore around the world was deposited around this time. Okay. And that has allowed us to build our cities, our infrastructure, and the world that we've constructed around us for the sake of some cyanobacteria.
Well, that's a discussion for another podcast. I will watch that, and maybe we can do a little discussion on that. That'll be quite interesting. And there's a lot we can talk about. We can do a deep dive on a mapper, and because of course the scale of that is huge. You've got the mine already there. Okay, it needs rehabilitation. You've got a whole railway line to a full port, and okay, some work needs to be done on the port. But you know, there's so much there. It's a process to get through and get it back into production, which we said is possibly sort of 2.5 to 3 years. But, you know, there's a significant deposit there. You want to extend your life of mine beyond 16 years, didn't you, as well? And with an NPV there of, what, 949, was it, from memory? Yes.
Yeah, so it's 949. And, yeah, so after the
dollars or pounds?
Dollars. And that was at a lower iron ore price. It was about $118 for the 65%. So it's gone up by about 10%. But anyway, that's a different matter. But, yes, so after the licensing, after assuming that we've got financing and a completed DFS, you know, in 12 to 16 months, it would then take about 1.5 years to construct or rehabilitate the asset.
Yes, indeed. And of course, the DFS will update us all on the NPV and all that nice stuff that we need to know about the scope of a project. But thank you very much, Kieran. That's been fantastic talking to you. I'm sure we'll be talking a lot more. But for now, thank you very much for your time on the podcast.
No, thank you very much for taking the time. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.